When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. Here we are now, entertain us. And it's 30 years since Kurt Cobain died. Not a snooker fan, I suspect, but a lot of people turn on this podcast every week with those very words. We'll do our best. I'm going to start with a personal announcement. There's been a lot of talk about retirement this week from various people in the snooker world. And I think it's only fair that I clarify my own position, and people may be conflicted by this, but I just want to clarify, because there may have been stories and you may have heard things. I'm not retiring. I've been clinging on for dear life for as long as I can. So just to clarify, I'm not retiring. What else am I going to do, for goodness sake? Now, you can ask that of a lot of people who've said the same. Mark Selby, I think, we're talking, about, of course, about the Tour Championship. You know, he lost his opening match. And we're talking about, you know, he might give it up after the World Championship. I mean, look, he's 5 in the world. He's still a top, top player. He had a bad day. I think he's felt disappointed by some of his performances this season. And we know that off table he's had things going on as well. And hopefully in the sort of clear light of day, he will sort of see things for what they are. But he's not the first player to do that by any means, to sort of have a bad result and question why he's putting himself through this. Because one thing about Selby, he works really hard, and you know, you put all the practice in, and sometimes you come to a tournament feeling great, and then it just doesn't happen, and you think, well, what's the point? Why am I doing this? Maybe there's other things I could do. Although whether there's other things he could do, you know, for the money he's earning each year is another matter. John Higgins, I think, is a slightly different one. He suggested the next World Championship may be his last. I think people have sort of missed the nuance of this a little bit. It's not a straight choice between. Or not necessarily a straight choice between playing on the World Snooker Tour and retiring. It may be that John Higgins feels this. I mean, I've not spoken to John about this, so this is my interpretation. But I do know that he's got a bit fed up of all the practice, because there's a lot of tournaments on the world ranking event circuit, and obviously to give yourself the best chance of them, you've got to put the work in. He's nearly 50, and it's easy to see why that wouldn't appeal to him at this stage of his career. Now, if he feels there's a chance to play in other events outside of the World Snooker Tour that won't take up so much of his time and presumably are lucrative, then maybe that's what he'll prioritise. I think we're going to find out a lot more about this in the near future, about what's happening next season. All I'll say right now, because we'll certainly revisit it, but all I'll say right now is if the players are smart, if they're smart, then they can actually pretty much clean up in the future, because I think some of the rules will be relaxed about what they can play in and what they can't play in, and it may be they can just basically play in loads of stuff on the World Snooker Tour and elsewhere as well. So we'll find out more about that in due course. Mark Williams as well in the same boat. I think that the older players are kind of looking to their futures now, and okay, they've left a legacy already, but you know, in the near future, do they want to slog around the circuit? Are there other opportunities that they can chase? And as I say, we'll find out more about that in due course. There are other retirements to speak of, and one of them actually, I was kind of saddened by it, and we've had a note here from Lucas, who's also quite saddened by. Rolf Kaub has been a commentator for German Eurosport since Eurosport began in 1989. So we're talking there 35 years, and Rolf, one of the most enthusiastic people about snooker you'll ever meet. He has educated a nation, and enthused a nation on snooker. He used to send away, or people used to send him videotapes of snooker in the 80s, you know, before it was on German television. When tournaments started to go to Germany in the 90s, he was, you know, the commentator, the MC, all of this. We see him at the Tempodrome every year, and he is a big figure in German snooker, and indeed in snooker broadcasting. He's decided at the end of the season after the World Championship that he's going to retire. He's given a lot of time to the game, and would like some time back. And I think that's the point. You know, the most important thing I think you can give to anything, actually, is your time. And 35 years is a long time to be commentating. But anyway, we've had an email from Lucas, as I say. He says, you may have already read or been informed, but Eurosport Germany commentator Rolf Kaub announced he will retire after the World Championship. Although I don't listen to your commentary as I don't live in the UK, I hope that your voice will remain with the snooker fans for a long time to come. Well, as I've clarified, Lucas, I'm clinging on as long as I can. He says, maybe I will look for a way to get access to the UK commentary from next season. Snooker in Germany without Rolf Kalb is possible, but pointless. I think I will shed some tears after the final, more than I've ever shed because of any player. Do you commentators from other countries all know each other, and are you in contact with them during tournaments? Well, the answer to that, firstly, obviously, you know, I hope you carry on watching snooker, and I'm sure, you know, after Rolf, someone will come along, and there's a guy Harry there who does it, and there's other people who will do it, and things carry on. We're in a big WhatsApp group, as is the way these days, with the other commentators. Obviously, we're all in different parts of Europe. I've met some of them, and you know, they're all very enthusiastic. I've met Rolf several times. So we are all in contact, and yeah, it'll be a sad day for sure. And you know, Rolf, he doesn't just commentate, he also, behind the scenes, does a lot of work every day for the commentators. He prepares his own sort of stats pack and sort of filling in the information and literally just collating things like the centuries from the day before, how it affects the all-time centuries, other things as well. Does a lot of work, you know, when play stops, he doesn't stop. He'll be working for a good hour and a half after that, you know, and you can imagine some of the late nights that that entails. And I hope Rolf doesn't mind, because he sent round an email explaining his retirement, and I just wanted to quote one line which I thought actually kind of summed him up, and actually to some degree sums up what it's like to work on the snooker circuit. He says, I felt welcome in the snooker family, and I will always be deeply grateful for that. Thank you. Thanks to all of you for welcoming me into the family. I was always proud of this and always will be. It was a privilege. Very classy, I think. And, yeah, good luck to Rolf in his retirement. And, you know, we need these enthusiasts and people who sort of go the extra mile for the sport. He didn't just turn up and do the job. He goes beyond that. And I'm sure he'll be watching. I'm sure he'll be watching in the future. Now, there's a couple of other people as well who are also retiring. They've both been on the podcast, actually. Now, 2 years ago, you can go back and listen to the back... not the back issues, the back episodes. I did an episode about how ITV snooker produce their snooker programmes, and two people on that are actually retiring. Sally Blower is, well, she's not retiring from actually ITV, but she's leaving the snooker team. She's the production manager, and I know Sally listens to the podcast, and she'd probably be listening to this on the way home on Monday, so I'm not going to say anything before then, but Sally, if you are listening, thanks. She looked after so well, and make sure we have everything we need so we can go and do our jobs. You know, there's a lot of talk when it comes to TV snooker about the people in front of the camera and behind the microphones, but the real work is done by the production team, and Sally has been leading that brilliantly for quite a few years. And also Duncan Richmond. Now, Duncan is one of the camera operators, and they are, I think, the real unsung heroes of the television production. Obviously, they are responsible for getting into position to offer up the shots that the director will cut to show you these tournaments. Duncan first became a cameraman in 1978. He started doing snooker in 1997, and he's retiring after the Tour Championship. So on Sunday, that will be the last tournament for him. And again, you know, just a great person to have had on the tour, very committed, very professional, good-humoured, you know, enjoys his work, takes it seriously but doesn't take himself too seriously. Typical, actually, of most of the people that I work with and know on the media side, the television production side of snooker. And Duncan, again, thanks for all your, you know, years of service. And I think it's worth sort of just tipping our hat as well to the other camera operators. Most of them do most events, so they know the game, they know where to stand, what shots to offer, what position to get in, and crucially, of course, when to keep still so they don't put the players off. And you very rarely, if ever, see any trouble with a player sort of complaining about a camera person. It just doesn't happen, because they know, they're respectful of the game, they understand it, and they know where to be. So, Duncan, again, hopefully you enjoy your retirement. Now, I'm in Manchester. You may be able to hear trams going past. It's true what they say about the rain here, but we won't sort of... I was going to say we won't indulge in mindless cliche, but that's frankly all the podcast is. But anyway, we've had two tournaments. We've had the mixed doubles and the Tour Championship. The mixed doubles was won, as you will be aware, by Luca Purcell and Rhianne Evans. I was very happy for Rhianne. You know, she's been the trailblazer, the figurehead of women's snooker for two decades, and now she's won a tournament on television. And Luca, it was always nice to see him playing. It was a good partnership. They were very sort of friendly from the off. They were smiling. They were laughing off errors and mistakes. Of course, they had to win their last frame in the group section against Mark Selby and Rebecca Kenner to qualify for the final, but they did, and they won the final. Luca played well in that match. I think that was the best match by some distance in the tournament. And it was a great victory for them. We've had some correspondence on the mixed doubles. Tom Milliard. I hope this email finds you well. Watching the mixed doubles event this year has raised a few issues. The idea of the event is to highlight the women's game and wonder if this has been achieved successfully. Ultimately, the standard of all the female players in the event has been poor, with all of them appearing nervous and hardly making a 20 break. While the event does indeed get female players on the TV, does it really benefit the women's game in general? Probably it doesn't help being directly compared to the elite level players. Almost all the matches have been drawn out affairs with little fluency or tension so far. Maybe a format change would help the event, perhaps six reds or alternate shots with a shot clock. While I don't usually hold much stock with online comments, this weekend's event has been completely panned, and I must agree, some of it is justified. I'm curious what the TV figures will be, and also what female viewers and players make of the event. Keep up the good work. Looking forward to your commentary on the Tour Championship this coming week. Thank you, Tom. That was sent on Sunday night, just Sunday afternoon when the final was yet to be played, but he'd seen enough of it, Tom, to form a view. On the figures, actually, they were good, actually. I mean, that's just a fact that the final got more than Monday's Tour Championship on ITV4. So people did tune in. My view on this, actually, I'll give you it straight. I thought last season's event was better for some reason. And I think one of the reasons, actually, is the timing in the season. It was played early season. The current time in the calendar, you know, the Tour Championship in itself is a massive event. You've got the World Championship coming up, which everyone's thinking about. Tour survival, all that sort of stuff is all in the minds of players in various parts of the ranking. It seems almost a too serious time in the season to have what is supposed to be more of a fun event. I think maybe as an early season event, it would work better. And I think it did work better last year. It may also be that it would be better if you actually reverted to straight knockout. Now, obviously, that would mean that there'd be less exposure for the players because they potentially only have one match. But the group phase, because you're sort of, certainly early on, you're not out, you know, you're not through, you're not out, you're just sort of playing. It's not that the matches were meaningless by any means, but it wasn't quite clear what it sort of meant until later. Whereas a straight knockout match, and we saw this with the final, if you've got to win, if you have to win, I think that does actually change the mindset of the players. The other thing to say, though, is, you know, you mentioned the women struggled, and I think that's true, but the men struggled as well. The first day on Saturday, nobody played well. Basically, nobody played well on the first day. I think there was 150 break at the end from Neil Robertson. They all struggled, and I think that's the nature of doubles. You know, it's stop-start. Some of the players have said this themselves. It's stop-start. You know, you're waiting ages. You play, you know, you play a shot. Maybe you pot a red. You might roll up to a colour. Now, normally in single snooker, you know, hopefully you've got a mistake out of your opponent. You might be in. But actually, three people have got to play before you get your next shot. So things have moved on by then, and whatever you had planned has changed completely. It's completely altered. So maybe, you know, straight knockout would just make it a bit more serious. I spoke to a couple of fans, and one of them pointed out, I think it's a good point, it was a nice family audience in the arena. A lot of women and younger people as well. Children were there. So on that basis, that's a good thing. I thought the Saturday, objectively, was a poor day of snooker. I don't think there's any point pretending otherwise. I think Sunday was better, and as I say, I think the final was good. So it may be that the format will be tweaked. One thing I was saying, I'll get onto this with the Tour Championship, the venue here, Manchester Central, is sensational. It's named after an old railway station, but it's a good name because it is central. We're right slap bang in the centre of Manchester. Lots of things to do around and about. You know, hotels and restaurants, shops, bars, all the rest of it, all the things that you'd want to do. We've been saying, a lot of us for a long time, come to a big city. And they've come to a big city and it is an absolute success. And we've seen the crowds of the Tour Championship. They were queuing in the rain for Ronnie O'Sullivan in his first round match against Ali Carter for over 2 hours in the rain. And indeed, Judd Trump, thankfully, against Mark Williams, it was sunshine on Thursday. Again, queuing up. Can't get enough of it, and that's brilliant. And we're going to be here for another 2 years, so that's all good. So the venue's good, and, you know, obviously if they'd moved it, as I suggested, to another time in the calendar, the mixed doubles wouldn't be here again. But there was plenty of support for it. I just think doubles itself, as a format, you know, actually isn't that great. And people have said, and I kind of thought, maybe play it like Davis Cup tennis, so I'm not sure the format is the same now as it used to be, but anyway, it was always, you had two singles matches, a doubles match, and two reverse singles matches. Of course, the problem with that is that's not doubles. That's not doubles, that's sort of team snooker. So maybe the format is looked at again, I don't know, but, you know, we've had not, I have to say, entirely great feedback on the event, and, you know, people can only judge on what they see, and not everybody kind of liked it, but a lot of people did watch it, despite that, it's got to be said. It wasn't a washout event by any means. We've got some more on the doubles here from Simon. As always, thank you for your excellent podcast, which continues to provide excellent insight into the game we all love. Not everyone's a cup of tea, but I enjoyed the mixed doubles, which took place over the weekend. In some ways, it made for an interesting watch, as it was a little bit different, seeing quite a few misses. I totally get it was very hard to establish a rhythm due to the one visit in four format of doubles. Rebecca Kenner had some good moments and clearly decided on a more attacking approach this time and made some decisive contributions. She has an interesting cue action in that she allows a large area from her bridge hand to the object ball, which must work for her, but will be a little restrictive, I feel, for the more delicate stud and screw shots. Additionally, when applying topspin, she hits very high on the cue ball. Who am I to question her technique, I say to myself, but if I was in her corner, I would suggest she looks at Rhiann Evans's technique, which is very solid and repeatable. I will end with my tip for the Worlds. I'm going for Mark Allen. Even last night, so this is obviously early in the week, when 4-1 down to John Higgins, he appeared well in control of himself and not overly worried. His temperament is excellent, and I've read this is an area he's worked on as well, of course, as his incredible weight loss. He's more than matched the safety guard of John, which makes him a serious player. Well, you know, Mark Allen is being tipped by quite a few people this year for the Crucible, and of course, as at time of recording, he's still in the Tour Championship. Let's move on to the Tour Championship. There's been some discussion on the format change, and some of it's a little bit inaccurate, actually, some of the things that have been said. There's a little bit 2 and 2 equals 5. I ran into a World Snooker board member this week who reminded me that the decision to raise the event from 8 players to 12 was actually made before last year's event in Hull, not afterwards. Has been sort of widely said. People have said it was a reaction to some of the big names not being there. That's not the case. They decided to come to Manchester and try and build the event up. And one of the various options for building it up, and one of them was to increase the field. Now, I was, myself and some of the other commentators were invited to a meeting last year to hear some of the views and ideas, and that's what they were at the time. And I listened to that. And he asked this, but board member asked me this week, what do you actually think of the format? And I gave an honest opinion, which is, I probably prefer 8, to be honest, because it was cleaner, because the field was halving 32 to 16 to 8. But I'm not against 12. The reason it's gone up to 12 is twofold. One, a general attempt to build the event up, so we come to a bigger city, a bigger venue, a bigger field, bigger prize money, bigger everything, in effect. The other, and this has actually borne out, is because they were worried that if you have one table and the match finishes early, that people are not getting value for money. And this was borne out on Wednesday when Ronnie O'Sullivan beat Ali Carter 10-2. There was only 50 minutes of snooker played on table one. And if that had been the only table, that would have been the only action anyone would have seen. And it may well have been, and it was packed. But the people who paid whatever they paid for those tickets would think, well, snooker's not actually value for money because we've seen less than an hour's entertainment. But what actually happened was, of course, the wall went up and they saw table two, which went on for quite a time. Same thing happened last night. Mark Williams beat Judd Trump 10-4. The wall went up and they saw, well, a good hour and a half, maybe 2 hours of Mark Allen against Ding Junhui. So on that basis, the plan that was put forward, we need to give better value for money by having the option to go to another table, has worked. It's not necessarily the best option for the broadcaster because obviously there's another table there and we don't get to see all of it. Having said that, we've been picking up when we can ends of matches and it's worked fairly well. The one that we didn't get to see was Mark Williams, Tom Ford, and of course Mark made that miracle clearance. But what I'm saying is this, it's been sort of reported that it was a knee-jerk reaction to Hull. That's not true. It was decided before Hull. Now, you can still argue that it was wrong, that's fine, and some players have said that, and other people have said it, and that's absolutely fine, and as I say, I like the 8, but it's not quite what's been sort of said about it. it was a genuine attempt to make it a bigger event, which I think it is, but a large part of that is coming to Manchester and this venue. It feels bigger, and hopefully the Tour Championship can grow in stature. You only really get that by through as the years pass, by, you know, more and more stagings, and it becomes established and people start to talk about it. I think we've had some correspondence on this. Paul, is there any reason why ITVX did not seem to provide second table coverage in the early stages of this year's Tour Championship? After finally making such a service available for the Players' Championship, it's disappointing that the feature has seemingly disappeared. Perhaps the Tour Championship should have been left as a top eight event, as Messrs. Alan Selby and Gary Wilson have suggested. Thanks for a great podcast. Well, I don't speak on behalf of ITV on these matters, but it's only ever effectively down to budget. It was offered at the Players' Championship. The take-up was not particularly big. You know, a lot of people have sort of harumped and banged their fist and said, we want to watch Table 2. But actually, when the option was given to them, they didn't really. They watched Table 1. But that's not to say it won't come back in the future. We'll see. You know, these things are pretty fluid. Joseph, in fact, it's Declan. You know, well, it's like Rumpelstiltskin. We got there in the end. Declan. I think there's a problem with the Tour Championship. This is Declan speaking. A major tournament just prior to the World Championship will be left overshadowed and will leave the top players less motivated to give it their best, as they'll be keeping something back for the Worlds. Also, spectators now have 5 weeks of multi-session snooker to watch. 1 week for the Tour, two for the qualifiers, and 2+ weeks for the Worlds. This is saturation snooker. Now, a lot of people, Declan, will be saying bring it on, but clearly you're not one of them. The two of the Triple Crown events are in the middle of the season, so why not put the Tour Championship as the first event of each season? It's a great way to start a season with the best players playing for a dominant start to their season. It's exciting for the spectators as well. The season will hit the ground running, each season bookended by a major event. It also gives the top players a deserving head start to the season if they take advantage of it, in case they flounder early on in other events and don't manage well on the one-year list. Start each new season with the best the sport has to offer, and then off to China for the whole tour. Also, the points won at the World Championship may or may not be included as qualification points for the Tour Championship at the start of the following season, based on assessing whether that is fair or not. I'd imagine that is fair. With the current arrangement, points from the game's biggest event do not manage to apply to qualification for the Tour Championship. With this new idea, they may apply if so desired, and may also be applied later in the season to the Grand Prix and Players' Championship, or not be applied as the case may be. My solution may not be the best one, but a solution is needed for the so-called fourth major, as it's in the wrong slot on the current calendar. As I say, it's completely overshadowed both the players and spectators. It's a no-win position at the moment. Well, strong words there. I think there's an obvious flaw in the logic. The whole point of the event is that it's part of the Players' Series, which starts at 32, goes down to 16, and then currently 12, some say it should be 8. If it's the first event of the season, how does that work? It doesn't, does it? The one place it can't be is at the start of the season. It's supposed to be best performances during the season, therefore it can only be held towards the end of the season. And I don't really get why it's overshadowed because of the World Championship. You know, the World Championship at the Crucible is a couple of weeks away. It's not like it's happening next week. The qualifying is, and we'll get to that later. But I just don't agree with that, I'm afraid. But thank you anyway for writing in. Just on a general point, and this is directed to players as much as anyone else. You know, we've heard criticism of the format, and people have a right to express their views, but it's not actually the case. It's not a rule that every tournament we come to, we have to start finding fault with things. You know, if you look around this event, it's packed every day. So that in itself tells you something about it. The public, you know, again, the mixed doubles was criticised. Well, the people who turned out and paid their own money didn't get the memo because they seemed to enjoy it. So, you know, we don't always need to look at the negatives. There are a lot of positives as well. And I think this Tour Challenge has been a great event. And as I record this on Friday, because we are now down to one table, let's have some follow-up from other issues, if you like. Neil Hargreaves. Now, we had an email last week from Holly about, well, I'll read Neil's email. Small follow-up to episode 294, responding to a listener question. This was Holly. Regarding the green mascot presented to Judd Trump after winning in Yushan. Please find a rough translation on the Xingpai Equipment Company website. Perhaps it's just niche enough to be of interest to your listeners. A huge thanks for the podcast from a first-time correspondent. It's absolutely brilliant, and he says that's written with a Phil Yates level of enthusiasm. So this is... Neil has kindly translated the explanation of this mascot that was handed out at the end of the final. So Little Jade, the mascot of the Chinese Snooker and Billiards Association, is based on Yushan's speciality white jade beans. I'm reading it. The overall shape is full, lively and cute, symbolising health, beauty and self-confidence. The design details are as follows. The young leaves on the head adding vitality to the image. The tilt of the eyebrows enhance the firmness of the eyes. White gloves and white boots echo the white jade beans. The bow tie is also the symbol of infinity, which not only represents the ever-changing nature of the game of snooker and the fact that everything is possible, but also that the game of snooker and the Yushan Snooker City have infinite room for development. They're saying a lot there about what is in effect a teddy bear. But anyway, good work, everybody. And, yeah, it's quite a nice thing to take home. I think if I don't know where Judd keeps it, but anyway, that's that. Where are we now? Matt Tarrant. Now, this email is headlined Hendon Camp, which many people have said. But anyway, we'll continue with the email. It says, in my opinion, the pod goes from strength to strength. Thank you for keeping it rolling. Thanks for responding to my crew. Now, Matt wrote in a few weeks ago pointing out that, I'd sort of said about snooker needs to be more international. Then why for then do I sort of bang the drum, as it were, for the Crucible? So anyway, he says, thanks for responding to my Crucible question a couple of weeks ago. I guess, yes, I was highlighting your hypocritical stance in wanting the game to be more international, whilst also wanting the jewel in the crown to stay in Sheffield. And you're right that I'm as guilty of the same hypocrisy, and maybe we all are. I love Sheffield, where I work 3 days a week. I love snooker. I love the Crucible. I have my tickets for this year, and I'm excited to visit again. The Iconic Moments episode reminded us all of why it's so special. Can I add 3 moments that stick in my mind? Okay, so here we go. This, because we had last week, and it's still available to listen to, of course, the Iconic Moments of the Crucible. People wrote in. I did my own top 20. So Matt here has got to some more. It says, Dennis kissing the trophy. What a fantastic camera shot with the focus shifting from the trophy to Dennis before he walks over to plant his smacker. Seconds after his miss in 85, Steve bringing his left hand to his head with his finger on his temple. For someone so controlled, an involuntary action in a moment of despair. Steve is my all-time favourite and in my mind will always be the greatest. Finally, in his break of 69, Alex Higgins smiling to someone in the crowd after potting a long black to move to 12. He looked so incredibly relaxed and happy. I remember at the time seeing that smile and thinking he's going to win the tournament. After being torn on the Crucible debate, I'm coming down firmly in the Hendon camp. I feel guilty as it's so handy for me to attend, but it's here and long may it continue. Prediction for this year, Trump beats the Rocket in the final or the semi, if seeded that way, and claims the trophy. Well, Matt, we will find out. Thank you for that. We'll find out in due course. Brian McGovern writes, I'm here watching a very enjoyable documentary on YouTube called 30 Years of Embassy World Snooker. Question is, do you remember the betting scandal between Jimmy White and Peter Francisco? There were bets for Peter to lose the match 10-2. I'd forgotten about it till it was mentioned in it. If you haven't seen the documentary, I'd recommend it. Enjoyable podcast as ever. Well, Brian, that was 1995. When you say involving Jimmy White and Peter Francisco ended up being banned for 5 years. It was nothing to do with Jimmy. He won the match. A lot of bets went on, the result being 10-2. I mean, it's a long time ago, this, but all I'll say is it was 2-2. So, you know, there wasn't really anywhere to go after that. It was 2 each, and he lost 10-2. But anyway, that's all in the past. Now, we've had a bit of feedback about the Crucible Moments episode, the Iconic Moments episode. Liz writes, I just finished listening to the Iconic Crucible Moments episode. A huge thanks to you and all the contributors for a wonderful episode. It's been the perfect warm-up to the tournament that we all love so much. Different Crucible list possibilities were also mentioned. I'd like to put in a bid for memorable moments involving referees. The 5 to come to my mind are, so we've got memories here involving referees. So number 1, Alex Higgins, 1994, Alex Higgins arguing with John Williams. Yeah, I mean, John Williams, you know, I mean, he was, if you go back to certainly the 80s and that was the 90s, he would have been probably on telly as much as the players. He always seemed to be refereeing, but a very strong referee. And Alex Higgins said he was in his way. And John Williams said, I've stood here all day, Alex. Don't tell me where to stand. You play, I'll referee. You know, it takes a lot of bottle to say that to the most fiery character the game's ever seen. But he did. And Higgins had to take it. Number 2 on Liz's list, 2017. Yamahas calling a foul on the black against Mark Selby. Yeah, I mean, that was obviously complicated by the sort of the TV studio getting involved as well. 2018, Brendan Moore, being jokingly shoulder-barged by Mark Williams after the O'Sullivan-Carter incident. 2023, Olivia Martil bravely tackling the Just Stop All protester. And 2023, also Brendan Moore enjoying Mark Selby's 147 in his final. I think we're going to hear, possibly today as I record this, so when, by the time you hear it, you might... the news might be out, but we're going to hear who the final referee is this year, and it's quite an interesting story, I think. List continues. I'm sure there are many more. I'd love to hear other contributions from fellow listeners. Meanwhile, I'm continuing my Crucible Builder by reading Brendan Cooper's excellent book Deep Pockets, Snooker and the Meaning of Life. Highly recommend it for anyone who's not yet picked it up. Thanks so much for a brilliant, surely soon-to-be award-winning podcast and all your excellent commentary. Thank you, Liz. Of course, Brendan Cooper was on the programme. The programme, that's a bit grand, the podcast, last year, discussing Deep Pockets, his book. I remember Len Gandy got involved. I was actually there in person. I actually saw this happen. Dennis Taylor was complaining about, he's playing Mick Price, I think, 1992, complaining about the misrule, and Len sort of had to stand his ground. There have been lots of incidents with referees. I mean, Alan Chamberlain that time with Graham Dott and Mark Selby, when Dott put his fist in the pocket and Selby picked the cue ball up and was fouled, all that stuff. But anyway, any more of those, let us know. Andrew Newman, just a short note. I just wanted to say I really enjoyed the Crucible Moments podcast. One of the best things about Snook I've listened to or read in the past year. It was the combination of listener contributions and then your own top 20 moments, of which I'd say about a third were a bit before my time as a snooker fan. I didn't start watching until the late 80s, early 90s. I love the ending too. Can't wait for whatever you do during the World Championship. Well, thank you, Andrew. Yeah, I mean, I think, well, you'd like to think people who listen to this podcast would, you know, enjoy the sort of, not nostalgia, but the reminiscence, I suppose, of great moments of the World Championship, because it's what the whole season builds towards. And we've had an email here from Cav in Ipswich. Cav says, thank you to you and your listeners for the special podcast dedicated to iconic Crucible moments. It really whetted the appetite for this year's forthcoming extravaganza, where I have two trips planned, one for the qualifiers and one for the second round of the Crucible, and I can't wait. For me, the love affair began with receiving a small snooker table as a present and soon afterwards stumbling across the 1983 World Championship on television. Most vivid early snooker memories being engrossed in the Tony Knowles-Cliff Thorburn semi-final. I preferred the younger and more stylish Knowles to the older and grizzled Thorburn. Knowles led 15-13, but of course Thorburn won 16-15. Though I was gutted Knowles lost, I was hooked on snooker. Thorburn's run to the final was quite astonishing that year. He had the maximum against Griffiths in the second round in a match that eventually finished 13-12 close to 4 a.m. That was followed by being 12-10 down to Kirk Stevens in the quarterfinals, but won 13-12 just after 2 a.m. and then beating Knowles in the semi-final decider not far off 1 a.m. It was no surprise there wasn't much left in the tank for the final against the all-conquering Steve Davis. I'm not sure how others view the 83 Championship, but for me, it was the spark that lit the flame. And though I didn't know it at the time, we were in the golden period for snooker. 6 months later, we had the 83 UK Championship, where Alex Higgins overcame Steve Davis 16-15 after being 7-0 down. That was shortly followed by the 1984 Masters, which included Kirk Stevens' 147, and there were many other special moments over the next few years, including three great World Championships between 1984 and 1986. What's reassuring is that as we roll the clock forward and as existing stars fade, they are always replaced by new stars who have their own rivalries and narrative. By the early 90s, the next generation of fans would no doubt have been just as enthralled by the Jimmy White-Stephen Hendry finals. By that time, I was in uni and missed most tournaments, but I've always made time for the World Championship. 10 years after that, in the early 2000s, we have the Williams, Higgins, O'Sullivan years. By the 2010s, Robertson, Selby, Trump have emerged. And in the 2020s, we can add Brussel and Allen to the list. I guess this is a long-winded way of saying that reminiscing about those treasured snooker memories does stir the heart and gives one a sense of well-being. But a quick look at the qualifiers for this year's tournament undoubtedly means new stories are just about to be written. Some of the big names in the qualifiers include Neil Robertson, C. Jarwee, Jack Lazowski, Hossein Vafai, Stuart Bingham, Steve McGuire, Graham Dott, Jimmy White and Ken Doherty. Well, thank you, Cav, for that, and Cav, for reminding us. Of course, the qualifiers start on Monday. Yeah, it's going to be a big 10 days. And just to say, as usual, it's going to be on Discovery Plus. We'll have commentary on table one. I think there's four streaming tables. Judgment Day on the World Snooker Tour YouTube channel, of course, and Facebook, and various other ways to watch it. But that's That's what's coming up from Monday. And, of course, if you, the qualifiers, as people will know, are kind of an event in themselves. But while we discuss 80s World Championships, of course, we had... Now, this podcast, OK, it's not won awards. We know it's not the world's biggest. That's been established as another one. We don't do live shows. We don't do much, frankly. But what we have done, and if this is a victory for the little man, and when I say the little man, I'm talking about Brian Dobson, because he wrote in discussing musical montages at the World Championship, and he mentioned one for the 1984 final. So day one of the 1984 final, Leo Sayer, Don't Wait Until Tomorrow, I think was the song. And he hadn't seen it for 40 years, and it wasn't on YouTube, but just a couple of days after the episode came out, it was put on YouTube by our dear friend, MJT Snooker, who I suspect must listen, and we don't know who this is. It's a bit like if you've seen All the President's Men, Deep Throat. I used to meet him in the car park, and no one knew who he was. Well, I'm saying that's MJT Snooker. We don't need to know who he is. He puts up great videos. I say he, it could be she. It's usually a he in these situations, I've got to be honest. But anyway, the fact is the video is now up. And it's, the breaking news is it's quite long. I mean, it's over 3 minutes. It's just that song. It's quite a sort of mournful song in a way. It's a bit melancholic, not the style of the time. And it's all footage from the first day of the final. But there it is. It's available. Brian got his wish. I count that as a small victory. And it just shows the stuff that's out there that people have recorded, and there's a sort of treasure trove of stuff out there. Duncan, we'll go to next. Just a minor quibble. I like that word. That's what's Duncan. So I'm not, that's my, not my comment, it's Duncan. Why do nearly all the commentators, Hendry apart, see it as a good thing when a player doesn't take on a 50-50 pot and play safe? He played the right shot there is a familiar refrain. It's as if he misses this, he will leave everything on. What if he gets it? Brassell won the Worlds last year with a very attacking game, and it was great to watch. Anyway, looking forward to Sheffield, and thought what you said about the place at the end of the last excellent podcast was spot on, going on the first Sunday this month, and can't wait to keep up the good work. Whether pots are strictly 50-50, there's different scenarios. Sometimes you can absolutely see the reward for going for one, and sometimes you think it's madness. But you're quite right in what you say. If they get it, then it's kind of the right shot in a way. But you know, players have their own way of seeing the game and their own views on, you know, whether a shot's worth taking on or not. Stephen Hendry was very attacking, liked to go for his shots, and of course was good enough to get them. But sometimes, you know, it's more common sense maybe to back away a bit. Just, I think it depends on the exact scenario. Now, we've been going for over half an hour, and it's time we gave the people what they wanted. And some people were saying, what, you mean the end? Not quite. But Banal Meetings with Snooker Players is a long-running feature. And Hayden's written in here. He said, I love the podcast. Great commentary last night with Ken. I was at the Tour Championship for Ronnie V. Carter and Ding V. Allen. I've got two Banal Meetings for you. Firstly, I saw Mark Allen leaving the practice area. I said, good luck, Mark, and he responded with a thumbs up. That's exactly what we want. And secondly, and my favourite of the two, I spoke to another great of the snooker podcast world, Phil Seymour. I began by telling him that I enjoyed his podcast. Don't worry, I would have said the same to you. He told me he just texted Sean to arrange recording the next one. He then complimented my shirt and asked where I got it from. It was bright orange, and I'd worn it so my family could spot me easily on TV. Well, there we are. So it's not quite so banal, because it seemed you had a conversation with Phil there. But anyway, thank you. We'll put it in the pile, I suppose. Grace in Galway. Hello from a sleepy Dublin airport. I'm here waiting for a flight to Manchester to attend the Tour Championship. I'd several hours to kill, so I'm re-listening to the Christmas special with yourself, Nick and Phil. You're so funny, I'm laughing away to myself, with the guy opposite looking at me like I'm a demented Egypt. These are Gracie's words. Although at this hour, everyone is probably a bit loopy. I've just seen half a turnip in the woman's toilet. Can't even imagine what that's about. Now, we'll get on with the rest of the email soon, but let's just go back over this here. You've seen half a turnip in the women's bathroom. I mean, well, I don't know. I don't know what to say about that, but we'll move on. There's loads of times I meant to write in to compliment you on the podcast, although it may be the world's smallest snooker podcast, is by far my favourite. There's probably plenty of questions I should ask you, but my brain isn't functioning right now on the lack of sleep, so I can't think of any of them. I'm not saying you imagine the turnip, Grace, but the evidence is stacking up. Anyway, she continues, I could finish off with a banal meeting with a snooker player involving myself, Alan McManus, and a self-cleaning coffee machine. What I like about this is she doesn't then tell that story, because I think, you know, we'd all like to plump up a cushion and find out how that went. But anyway, she says, instead I'll finish with a banal sighting of some snooker commentators. While staying in a hotel, I was quickly walking towards the lift when I saw two men carrying bags standing waiting. I did a quick mental calculation, figured the three of us wouldn't fit in the lift together, so I turned around and took the stairs instead. The men were yourself and Phil Yates. Now, the thing about this story, we don't exactly look chivalrous there, do we? I mean, I don't know where this was. I can assure you, I would have just got in the lift and expected you to walk up the stairs, had I realised, but apologies for that. We don't come out of that well, frankly. She says, I'm at the Tour Challenge for the next 4 days, so I'd like to have several more riveting, banal sightings of snooker-related people. Thanks for all your brilliant work on the podcast and commentary. Your voice is my often companion on work-from-home days. Well, thank you, Grace, and if there's any more information on that business with the coffee machine, and indeed the turnip, let us know. Now, Vincent has written in here. He says, once again, a quick one to say thank you for continuing with the podcast on a weekly basis. It's essential listening. There are quite a few banal snooker player meetings. Obviously, this term is used very loosely. Rather than add to the banality by stagging them, I thought I would just summarise them all in one hit. Please feel free to share as few or as many as you see fit. I don't want to bore the listeners to tears. Well, Vincent, it doesn't stop me, does it, every week? So I will read them all out, actually. Why not? So here goes. Number one, Mark Selby. There are these banal meetings with snooker players. So there's no rules as such, but it helps if very little interaction takes place, basically. Anyway, here we go. Number one, Mark Selby in the queue in front of me at the canteen food-type counter on the ground floor concourse that was used by the general public and players alike at the K2 in Crawley at the English Open. My reaction, to keep my distance, I didn't want to crowd Mark or seem like I was in any way hurrying him. I allowed Mark to complete his transaction and leave the counter. I didn't speak a word. Number two, Terry Griffiths in the queue in front of me at the canteen food-type counter on the ground floor concourse that was used by the general public and players alike at the K2 Crawley at the English Open. My reaction again, I kept my distance and allowed Terry to complete his transaction. Terry exchanged pleasantries with a member of staff behind the food counter. I didn't speak a word. From memory, it was a hot drink that he ordered. I think it was tea. Well, this is important information. Number three. Alfie Burden and a fleeting Neil Folds on the upper floor concourse at the K2 Crawley. Alfie was trying to garner Neil's attention by saying, Foldsy, Foldsy, in a slightly raised voice. My reaction, I had a brief look up and then awkwardly looked at the floor to prevent eye contact being made, which could have potentially led to some dialogue. No word spoken. Okay. Number four. There's a lot happening here in Crawley. Stuart Bingham on the upper floor concourse at the K2 Crawley. Stuart was sitting down eating a savoury pasty snack, talking to a non-snooker playing gentleman. I believe from memory Stuart had a Cornish pasty, but I'm not 100% sure. My reaction, a brief look up, no words exchanged. I didn't want to interrupt Stuart when he was eating. Okay, number five, and we move location here now. Number five, Dave Gilbert strolling through the concourse at the Motorpoint Arena in Cardiff at the Welsh Open. My reaction, a brief look up, long enough to recognise who it was, but not long enough to be classed as a stare. Once I realised who it was, I awkwardly looked at the floor, no word spoken. And number six, finally, Sean Murphy leaving the Motorpoint Arena in Cardiff at the Welsh Open. My reaction, coincidentally, I was leaving the Motorpoint Arena at the same time as Sean. He was in front of me and politely held the door. I did mutter the word cheers quietly under my breath. And that really is it. All six banal meetings. Well, thank you very much, Vincent. And, yes, you did well there to effectively not speak to anybody, it seems. Now, Chris writes, I've been a long time listener to your podcast and it is great to keep it up. Thank you, Chris. I have a few comments on various topics you discussed over the last while and sure I'll hit you with them now. Better late than never, as they say. First, I'm a Ronnie fanboy, like everyone else, I suppose. So the below are mostly comments on him, unsurprisingly, so please bear with me. To start, I didn't particularly love the documentary that came out. This was The Edge of Everything, of course. To anyone more familiar with his story, it seemed more of the same, albeit bits were great, and I was expecting more of him practising and the more snookery side that we don't see. I wonder what your thoughts are on that. Well, I suppose, Chris, they were sort of trying to aim it at a wider audience as possible, and maybe they didn't want to put too much snooker in because they didn't want to sort of alienate people. It was more about the man than the player, I guess. I can't speak for them, but when you're making a film, 2 hour film, you've got to make decisions when you've got a lot of footage, what exactly you're going to use and what the shape of the story is. Chris continues, crucible moments. I didn't hear one person mention his shoulder bars with Ali Carter. That sticks out for me. And the needle in their matches is something that makes the matches so much more watchable. More needle is needed in general. Yeah, I mean, that was on my... I mean, I did 20. That was on my list initially. Someone mentioned Andy Hicks and Quinton Hand. But I kind of... I don't know. I kind of just... It's not that I focused on more positive things, but I don't know in the great story of the Crucible whether that incident is as important as some of the others. What did it represent other than a bit of brief aggro, really, I suppose? Chris continues, one criticism I have of the great man is that I don't like the way he won't go for 147s. I think it lets his fans down. It takes a lot of money to travel and get a ticket to see him, etc. I suppose the 147 against King makes up for that. It has to be the best display of flair ever on a snooker table. But still, we want more, more, more. His form this year has been solid and he's gone supernova versus Ding early this year and showed glimpses of that form in spurts. He's obviously putting the hours in. It would be a brave person to bet against him for the Worlds. Hopefully at a Selby showdown somewhere would be brilliant. Anyway, that's my Ronnie washing over. P.S. Why won't Stephen Hendry practice? He definitely still could be a force, or at least get to the Crucible if he practiced. Ronald is showing age is a number, and Hendry definitely has the talent. It would be great if he practiced, but alas, we can't have it all. Goodbye, bye from Chris. Thanks, Chris. Well, Chris, I mean, Stephen Hendry's not entered the World Championship. I think this is the... I was talking about John Higgins earlier. This is the sort of bore as you get older. He's actually putting the work in. And you're quite right, Ronnie O'Sullivan does, and that's to his credit. He does work hard. He's committed to doing that. But, you know, when you've done it all your life, I think Hendry, you know, would like to continue playing, but you're not going to get results if you don't practice. But he's got other things going on, you know, the work, and, you know, he's sort of prioritising that, I guess. Declan writes, second email from him. I was wondering whether Zach Shurity's 147 is the cleanest ever made. He cannons two reds off potting the first black to hold the white, not to develop the reds. From that point, till he pots the last black for 147, the only time the white strokes another ball is to pot it. Is this not unique? Without watching every 147 ever made, I don't know. But this point was made by Neil Robertson, actually, at the time, that he didn't play cannons. Apart from that initial one you mentioned. So, I mean, that is something pretty impressive. I mean, it was a great break. It really was. Back to Ronnie O'Sullivan. Martin Eccles writes, would the 888 Ronnie O'Sullivan win, so obviously this is an eighth world title to follow the UK in the Masters, would it be the biggest win for snooker as a whole, newspaper front pages, etc.? Loving the pod. Well, Martin, I mean, it will be huge, obviously. I think whoever wins it, there's a story, isn't there? But yeah, I mean, Ronnie's a very recognisable figure, so I wouldn't disagree with that assessment. Marlon has written in. Now, this is a cracking email, actually. He said, I didn't think I had anything to add to your excellent music and snooker item. Then I remembered that during the 2000s, me and some close friends created a musical snooker group made up of current tour professionals. We all played in a band and lived in a house together in South Manchester where we rehearsed in the basement. Myself and the bassist were big snooker fans, so it was always on the TV. It wasn't long before we noticed the prevalence of current snooker professionals sharing their name with famous musicians. There was even enough for us to form a hypothetical full six-piece snooker band. So here, in all its glory, is our snooker supergroup. Okay, so rhythm guitar and backing vocals, multi-platinum selling songwriter, most famous for his chart-topping hit Babylon, and former UK finalist and Scottish Open champion David Gray. A lead guitar. Turning pro in 1992, winner of four ranking titles, and founding member and lead guitarist of Aerosmith, Joe Perry. Joe's won two ranking titles, but that's fine. That's fine. The frontman, former British Open finalist, Grand Prix finalist, who had a big hit with Nothing Lasts Forever, is the lead vocalist of Echo and the Bunnymen, and former top 16 player, Ian McCulloch. I mean, Echo and the Bunnymen, you know, The Killing Moon, bigger hit, I think, but anyway. On bass, known for his slap style of playing with Music Radar, describing him as the guy who put the slap in pop during the 80s, he received a Basker Gold Badge Award in recognition of his contribution to British music. He is, of course, the lead singer and bassist of Level 42 and former world number 11, who was on the Pro Tour for 22 years, Mark King. I think 32 years. I don't like to be correcting things here. It sounds small, but anyway, I am still doing it. On trombone and harmonica, world-renowned folk musician and Roar Open champion Rory McLeod. And finally on drums, M. Joyce, because Mike Joyce from The Smiths and snooker pro Mark Joyce were as close as we could get for a drummer, but not bad considering there was only 82 players on the tour at the time. Thanks for the podcast and season's greetings for this most wonderful time of the year. Thanks, Marlon. That's all great, but what you haven't done there is name the band. What would the band be called? And also, what sort of music would they make, let's be honest. But yes, anyway, thank you for that. Now, Mark Baisley writes, after the barracking you received for your hot take on The Big Lebowski, I called it twice last time, The Big Lebowski, so it kind of got in my head, and maybe that's the point, it got in my head, but it was The Big Lebowski. I did give it a bit of a shoeing, and you know, it didn't go down well, but anyway, Mark continues, after the barracking you received for your hot take on The Big Lebowski, I hope it was only fair to write and commend you for your praise of the New Radicals' Maybe You've Been Brainwashed 2 album. I thought it was just me who liked it and bought it. On that note, I might as well contribute my own song I associate with snooker, that being Pure by the Lightning Seeds. This is for two reasons. One, for some reason, it's a song I always associate with late November, early December, and therefore the anticipation of the UK Championship being just around the corner. And two, because I remember listening to it when I was reading Bill Burrow's excellent book on Alex Higgins, The Hurricane. And just on that, I mean, that's such a terrific song, Pure, by the Lightning Seeds. In fact, the Lightning Seeds, you know, I mean, in other countries, they'd be putting statues up to these people. Ian Brody, and let's hope he's a long, long time, but when he passes away, no doubt it'll be the man who wrote the Three Lions song with Badil and Skinner. No. There's a lot more, to his oeuvre than that. And the Lightning Seeds, I would Jollification, great album. Anyway, we continue. I've got a couple of banal meetings with snooker players for you as well. The first was in my student days in the early 2000s when I had a part-time job in a Wellingborough supermarket. One day, I was walking into work and there was Peter Ebden perusing the ready-made sandwiches. We made eye contact as he turned around, but given it was just days after being knocked out of the first round of the 2004 World Championship by Ian McCulloch, I didn't really know what to say, so just smiled and carried on walking. The other was during the 2009 Pro Challenge Series event at Willie Thorne Snooker Club in Leicester. I'd gone along as a spectator, and as I was leaving, Mark Davis was walking the other way. We nodded at each other, and I may have mumbled, "All right, Mark," as well, and both went on our way without breaking stride. Talking of Willie Thorne, me and my parents did see him with his family at Cadbury World on a day out in the mid-1990s, although I don't count this as a banal meeting, as no contact was actually made. Well, there's plenty to digest there. But anyway, we'll move on to Phil Spivey. I absolutely loved the last episode, re-iconic Crucible moments, and thought your own top 20 really hit the mark. You also asked for suggestions of great World Finals, so here are some of mine. Okay, so this is Phil's sort of personal list of great matches. 2018, the one that many now perhaps regard as the best ever. Great drama, great quality, a great story, with Mark Williams reaching the crescendo of his renaissance. It would be great if I reached the crescendo of my renaissance, but anyway, we'll maybe monitor that. 1985, the most iconic. One thing that strikes me is that the tussle on the black ball at the end is just about the perfect length. 7 shots in all, 4 for Taylor, 3 for Davis, with both players having at least one chance to pot it before Taylor actually does. And the brown, blue and pink for Taylor to set at the finale is arguably the best 3-ball break in snooker history given the situation and the difficulty of each pot. 2000s, perhaps an underrated classic. Matthew Stevens was such a heavy scorer with a game built for long matches, but Mark Williams' ice cool comeback made for a thriller. 2006, an epic rather than a classic. However, I've included this because Graham Dott is often referred to with backhanded compliments and faint praise, but he was and is a fantastic player. All world champions are. He's unfairly regarded sometimes as a slow and defensive player, but there's much more to his game. In this final, he was up against Peter Ebden in the midst of his peak grind era. 2014, snooker's greatest ever rivalry over 2 days. The script suggested a third successive Ronnie O'Sullivan win, but Mark Selby put pay to that and possibly the most significant of finals this century. They are likely in opposite halves of the draw this year. Anyone for a rematch? 2015, a great quality final between two players who maybe wouldn't have been many people's predictions before the event. Of course, that was Stuart Bingham and Sean Murphy. 2021, an intriguing match. It showcased what Selby's so good at. He does his best work in the second and third sessions, true of all 4 of his World Championship wins. Once he got ahead at 10-7, Murphy never got closer than 2 frames behind. Yet Murphy contributed to a fine match by pushing Selby all the way while not compromising his attacking style. And who knows what might have happened if he potted the final red down the cushion in the 33rd frame. Can't wait for this year's edition. The great thing about the tournament is that whoever wins, whether it's a multiple winner or a complete surprise. It'll be a great story. Bring it on. And thank you, Phil. So say all of us, Phil. Couple more. Reese writes, I'm currently listening to your podcast while working and had to stop, pull out my phone and write you this email. As your fast-thinking line, good if you're playing safe, while describing the matchroom condom, deserved appreciation. Unbelievable. I've been laughing in the street. Well, there you are, Reese. You laugh once during the podcast, then that's good news, isn't it? But thank you for that. Now, Constantine from Greece wrote in last time with a query about total titles, and I kind of explained the criteria I use, and you say, thank you, David, for replying to my question. I still have a slight objection about Ronnie's titles. I think he's tied with Davis for most on 81. I'm not including in my count Power Snooker, Ham Invitational, Pink Ribbon, Irish Masters 98. Maybe I'm wrong. In any case, I trust your expertise, and even if Ronnie's on 79, it's just a matter of time to go past Davis and thus break another record as the player with most professional titles in snooker history. In fact, as difficult as it is, I believe Ronnie is capable of making a century by winning 100 titles. Keep doing great, David. I love your podcast, and I really enjoy listening to your commentating, reading your articles, and watching your interviews. Well, thank you, Constantine, for that feedback. Phil McCoy, great podcast from a regular listener and sporadic contributor. I'm curious to learn about the accommodation arrangements players make when playing in tournaments. Is there normally an official hotel associated with the tournament the players are expected to stay in, or are they free to stay wherever they like depending on their budgets? If it's the latter, surely you're relying on the hotel to offer flexibility, as you never know how long you'll be a guest for, as obviously this relates to how deep into the tournament a player goes. I'm wondering if you could shed any light on this curiosity of mine. Well, Phil, there isn't normally an official hotel as such. Sometimes World Snooker Tour can get rates. In fact, the players themselves can possibly get rates, you know, a discount to stay somewhere. Normally overseas, outside Britain, in China, wherever, there is an official hotel. But, for example, here in Manchester, yeah, you can stay wherever you want. You're right. I mean, it's a bit of a faff sort of sorting it out, because obviously you don't know how long you're going to be here. You hope you'll be here for the week. You might only be here for one night. So players do have to have sort of flexible bookings, and hotels can do that. And it's just part of the sort of business of being a snooker player, really. But there's no, at this tournament, there's no official hotel. People are in Airbnbs or staying in hotels, plenty to choose from. And that's another good thing about coming to a place like Manchester. You know, there's plenty of places where you can stay. Hugh Grant, but not that one, has written in here. Thank you for reading, commenting on my recent correspondence. I'll be travelling from Australia to Sheffield for the last 5 days of this year's World Championship. As a big fan of you and your podcast, I truly hope I'm able to meet you during that time. Anyway, my latest question relates to the legality of purchasing second-hand tickets for the 2024 World Championship. I'm still trying to purchase tickets for the semi-final and final sessions, but as you know, they're extremely difficult to obtain, particularly if you only go through the official ticket agents, Sheffield Theatres and Sea Tickets. I note there are very expensive tickets available for sale through unofficial secondary marketplaces such as Viagogo, Exchange Tickets, etc. However, I'm unsure whether those tickets are technically valid, as my understanding is that the ID of the person using the ticket must match the ID of the ticket purchaser, and it doesn't appear that the owner of the ticket is altered when purchasing tickets through those unofficial forums. I appreciate the Crucible Theatre staff don't routinely ask for or check the ID of the person entering the theatre, but I'm interested in understanding whether tickets from unofficial secondary marketplaces are actually valid. I've made a few inquiries attempting to get an answer to this question from the various secondary marketplaces, but so far I've been unable to get a straight answer. Anyway, thank you again for everything you do for snooker. I truly hope I'm able to meet you in Sheffield in early May. With regards and deepest respect, Hugh. Well, I'm going to be careful how I answer this, because I don't actually know the answer for sure. And I think listeners, people listening to this podcast, will be better placed to know whether what the situation is with this. Because what I would not want to do is advise anybody to buy tickets from a source and then they can't actually enter the venue. So if anyone has done this, maybe they can let us know what the deal is there. You know, what sort of, do they ask for ID or not? Have you had any problems if you bought second-hand tickets? Because I don't want to sort of blunder in with an answer and then find out it sort of spoiled your trip or anything. You can let us know. snookerscenepodcast@mail.com is the address. We've had an email here and from Nina. Please speak more slowly. Not all snooker supporters have English as a first language. Well, I understand that, Nina, but I can only really... I think you left a review saying this as well on Apple Podcasts. I can only really speak the speed I speak. Someone did write in to say you can slow the podcast down. to sort of half speed, although it may be that I'm speaking too quickly for you to sort of get that message, but I can only speak how I speak, I'm afraid. Paul Moyes, long-time listener, first-time correspondent. As many others have said, the Snooker Scene podcast is essential listening for me. With your vast snooker knowledge, common-sense views on the issues facing the game, and sardonic wit, which often makes me chuckle. Long may it continue, and thanks for all you do for the game. Well, thank you, Paul. This is, I wanted to mention a topic you touched upon in a recent episode. It's something that's been starting to annoy me for a while now, while watching snooker on TV or via streaming. That's the issue of how we see the movement of the cue ball around the table and the way TV producers seem to be relegating it in favour of constant close-up crowd shots, etc. One of the great joys of watching snooker is, in my opinion, seeing the whole table layout and how the frame develops as the balls move and cannon and interact with each other. And the cue ball is central to this. Nowadays, it seems increasingly we have to put up with non-stop chopping and changing of camera shots to pocket angles, crowds, player reactions, etc. at the expense of what is actually moving on the table. For example, when a player has a fairly routine, just off straight pot on a black, on a red or black into the corner pocket, when it's clear the accompanying cannon into the pack or another ball is the really important part of it, we always get the behind the pocket camera shot, dutifully following the frankly unmissable pot into the hole. Meanwhile, we've missed the cue ball doing its magical work, developing the table or not for the following shots. We might get a replay of the cannon, but this just further interrupts the full table view, giving us even less time to survey the layout and positioning of the balls before the next shot is taken. Another example is the off-straight blue from its spot to break into the pack of reds. Again, we more often than not get the behind-the-pocket shot of the easy blue pot at the expense of seeing the cue ball do its work and cannon scatter the reds. Another particular bugbear is when the cue ball is still moving and the camera cuts to the crowd or player's reaction. "Where's the bloody cue ball going?" I shout to myself. I find out when the replays are done and we get back to the full table camera shot just before the player takes his next shot. For me, one of the joys of watching snooker is having the time to survey the full table tapestry of balls, working out potential next moves, obstacles and shots. The lay of the balls, all part of the wonderful strategy of chess with balls. But these days, there seems much less time to do it. In general, the modern trend seems to be to show less actual full table views of the frame and more fancy camera angles constantly changing and almost enough to make you dizzy. TV producers no doubt are thinking that snappy is better to attract younger audiences, perhaps. As you mentioned, for the recent Women's World Championship coverage, just give me a full static, full table view and I'm happy. I enjoyed the one fixed camera streaming of qualifiers, for example, often without commentary, giving me time and quiet to contemplate the lay of the balls. I'm not totally against using different camera shots and agree the rear pocket views can be useful, especially on more tricky pots and acute angles. Have you noticed this trend yourself, and if so, what do you think is behind it? Could it be that more modern, younger TV snooker producers perhaps know less about the game and think a static view of the whole table isn't exciting enough to attract the younger generation? Could someone perhaps tell them that the moving cue ball and its trajectory is one of the most important aspects of this beautiful game? Sorry for the little rant, but this has been on my mind for a while now and it feels good to get it off my chest. I'd be interested to hear if any other snooker fans have noticed this trend themselves, or am I chuntering to myself alone? Well, I mean, I do that most week, Paul, but, well, thank you, Paul. I mean, here's what I would say about this. Okay, directing a snooker match is not easy. You're trying to tell a story, and it's two stories you're trying to tell. One is the sort of snooker story, and the other is the human story, the drama, the human drama behind it. And so I think certainly reaction shots from players and can be overdone, but the crowd as well are good in building that story. But I agree with you that you want to see where the cue ball is. That's the most important ball on the table, you know. And one thing I have noticed is there's now a lot of replays of shots that often don't need to be seen again. And this is no particular broadcast. This is just a general sort of comment, really. But I think they do a great job in general because, as I say, they're trying to build two stories. The story of the frame in a snooker sense and the human drama behind it, the human story that accompanies it. And you know, I think overall they do that well, but I can see your point at the same time. Now, Alex writes in, embarrassed to say I've listened to the show since 2015. I've never written in to offer my appreciation for the work you do. As an American snooker fan in New York, where snooker tables are few and far between, the podcast truly helps me feel a part of the snooker scene. Inspired by the greatest email ever from this week's episode, I offer you ever more niche content in my submission. So this was a correspondent wrote in imagining snooker players as composers, and this I have to say I had a mixed reaction, but a lot of people enjoyed it. I had a player tell me how much they enjoyed it. But anyway, Alex has said here, so it's snooker players imagined as skateboarders. I hope the very small fraction of listeners who find themselves in the middle of the snooker skateboarding Venn diagram will appreciate my musings. I'm also hopeful that more lists like this will cement the show's status as the world's smallest podcast. I will spare you a list that's as long as the composers and give you three analogous pairings. Okay, so I have to say this is not my milieu, if you like, skateboarding, but I will read it out because it may appeal to some people, possibly. So anyway, so we've got here Steve Davis and Tony Hawk. Did incredible work to popularise and become the face of the sport. Didn't necessarily have the most dazzling style, but in terms of technique and execution, clinical. Slightly boring, but perhaps more interesting than people were willing to give credit. Okay, I'm taking all this on faith that these are real people, by the way. Stephen Hendry, Heath Kerchot, silent, brutal killers at their craft, did not care about socialising or trends, only being at the top. Once their abilities began to wane, they both preferred to retire rather than to draw out their careers. Ronnie O'Sullivan, Andrew Reynolds, raw natural talent, conquered demons surrounding mental health and substance abuse, unbelievable staying power to achieve at the highest level across the 90s, 2000s, 2010s and 2020s. And finally, Alex Higgins, Dustin Dolin, best ever at performing while drunk. That is all. Please consider selling merchandise. I'd gladly purchase a Snooker Scene podcast t-shirt and refrigerator magnet. Well, I mean, I don't know about that. It feels grubby, frankly, but having said that, it doesn't stop other people. I think we'll end with one more from Dave Daly, our dear friend in Seattle. He says, in a previous episode, you asked for World Championship winner predictions. This is an email. This email isn't that, as I honestly can't predict one. There are just so many great players these days who are capable of winning, it's too hard to predict. That said, I know you like your list, so instead of a prediction, I've listed the 10 people who I think would make a fantastic story as this year's winner. There are other great worthy winners I could add, but decided to limit it to 10. I haven't written those in preference order or indeed any degree of likelihood, but these are the outcomes that would please me for one reason or another. Okay, so these are 10 players who Dave feels would be good winners for the game and good stories. Number one, Ronnie O'Sullivan. That triple eight in 1 year story is hard to beat in terms of being iconic and special. He will inevitably win an eighth world championship at some point, so it may as well be this year, so we can talk about the triple eight. It would be legendary for many years to come and likely to ever happen again. Number two, Mark Allen, as he's too good not to get the world championship at some point in his career, he feels worthy to be next on the list of new additions. Number three, Ding Junhui, similar to Mark Allen, he's too good to never have won it. Of all the Chinese players who will possibly win it in years to come, I really do think it would be fitting for Ding to be the first to lift it from China. Number four, Luca Brasel. It would be nice to see that crucible curse finally broken and him proving he can show some consistency of form on the big stage. Number five, John Higgins. It was so amazing to see the Higgins-Williams final in 2018. I didn't mind which of them won it. It turned out to be Williams. It would be great to see John do it one last time. Call me nostalgic, guilty as charged. Number six, Judd Trump. I think there can be no doubt that by the end of his career, he'll be considered an all-time great, but I really don't want him to end his career still on the list of one-time winners. It's been 5 years since he won the first one. I think he needs that monkey off his back. Number seven, Neil Robertson. Similar to Judd, he's just too good to be a one-time winner. It's crazy to think he hasn't done it again. Number eight, Sean Murphy. We're on a roll on the topic of one-time winners here, so may as well add Sean to that list too. Another one too good to be listed as just a one-off. Number nine, Jack Lazowski. I really don't see it happening, this year at least, but how fun would it be that Jack's first ranking title ended up the biggest of them all? It's unlikely, but I'd love to see it. And number 10, Ricky Walden. Last but not least, and I'll bet you didn't expect that one. Why, you ask? Shock Outsider stories are great to see, and this will be my favourite Shock Outsider. He's generally one of the nicest people on the planet and a friend of the Ox community. This is the Ox Billiards Club, of course, in Seattle. And he said, I'd just love to see him back in the top 16 again, and winning the World Championship would be the cherry on the top. Any other people you'd love to see win? Thinking about the underlying story it would generate. See you in Sheffield. Yes, indeed, Dave. Thank you. Well, I think you've come across something there that's sort of self-evident in a way, but there's a lot of people who you say too good not to win it or too good to be a one-time winner. It's only played once a year. That's the problem. So some of these people are going to miss out. Just as players that the past generations missed out who were felt to be good enough. There's only one chance a year to win it. So some of those people will stay one-time winners, and some of those people will stay as people who've never won it. It's just very hard to win. There's a lot, you can make a case for lots of different people. Whoever wins the World Championship, it's a good story. It's a good story if someone comes out of the pack, like CJ Wee nearly did last year, out of nowhere and wins it. It's a good story if an established player wins it. I mean, Mark Williams, he's a player not mentioned there, but I mean, he seems to be back in form. Next week, hopefully, as long as we record it while we're here in Manchester, on Monday, this will be, you'll be able to hear predictions from myself, Neil Folds, Phil Yates and Alan McManus about what's going to happen at the Crucible or who might win it. So that'll be coming up Monday. And we barrel on towards the greatest snooker show on earth. Of course, it's sort of split into two now. The qualifiers are their own thing, their own entity, and very exciting in their own right. So they start on Monday, and of course we have then on the 18th of April, the Thursday, we have the draw for the first round. And if Neil Robertson qualifies, as seems quite likely, I think, looking at his draw, it's easy to say that, but I actually think it's quite possible that he will qualify. If he's in that first round draw, that'd be fascinating to see who he draws. Friday is a sort of Crucible Eve day. Everyone's getting ready for it. And then that's Friday the 19th. Then Saturday the 20th of April, it begins. And we will be there until May the 6th, of course, to find out who's going to be world champion. There's nothing better in snooker than that. And for all the sort of moans and groans that you hear about formats and this, that and the other, you know, I think everybody agrees, or I hope they do anyway, that the World Championship is an event that works brilliantly, and that if you're a snooker fan, you cannot wait for. And we don't have to wait too much longer, just a couple of weeks now until it all gets underway. But that's it for now. So thanks for listening. Snookerscenepodcast@mail.com is the address to direct any correspondence, support social network and all the rest of it. We are members of. And I think that's all I've got to say for this week. So we'll be back, as I say, on Monday with a special episode. You can also listen to me next week on the WPBSA podcast. Oh yes, I spread myself far and wide, and I'll be discussing the 1999 World Championship on that. So you can listen to that from Monday. But from now, as we always say on this podcast, it's goodbye bye. Sports Social Podcast Network.